You're listening to the Cash and Burn podcast, and I'm your host, Brandon Metcalf. Join me as I interview and have conversations with founders and leaders about the greatest obstacles and challenges they've faced while building their businesses. Learn how they overcame them and ultimately what made them successful. The podcast is brought to you by Place. Place is a B2B SaaS customer subscription management, billing, forecasting, and metrics platform powered by Salesforce. Growing SaaS businesses use Place to better align their revenue and finance teams so they can boost revenue growth and retention, manage renewals, collect cash faster, and make more informed decisions all directly inside of Salesforce. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cash and Burn. Today I have a fellow Austinite on with me, Mr. Dan Bilkowski from Product Tranquility. He's the founder and chief pricing officer. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing well, Brandon. Excited to be here.
Yeah, that's what is not a exactly 115 degree day here in Austin, but it's definitely a toasty one. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about who you are, what you guys are doing, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah, as you mentioned, my name is Dan Bilkowski. I run a consultancy down here in Austin, Texas, trying to stay cool, but we help high volume B2B SaaS CEOs define pricing and packaging for new and existing products.
So what does that actually mean? Like, give us a little bit more context about the scope of the full scope of the business.
Yeah. So, you know, that could range. Different clients come to us for different reasons. So, you know, what we see is generally if companies are, you know, debating a 5-10% price increase, usually not bringing in a consultant, usually there's some sort of structural shift that they're experiencing in their business. So maybe that's a 50-year high inflation that could be considered a structural shift in the market. Usually it ends up being something around the a new product. If they're expanding a new customer segment, and maybe they design their original pricing and packaging for an existing customer segment, and now they're starting to serve additional customer segments, and the pricing and packaging doesn't align their value story anymore. So that can be a signal. What I'm seeing quite a bit recently is a bit of an accelerated demise of a per user or per seat pricing metric model. So many companies who are familiar with, you know, CRM market, Salesforce, for example, you purchase Salesforce for any number of your sales folks. You know, there are a lot of companies priced that way. I'm generally agnostic whether that's a good or bad idea. It depends. There's ways to think through those decisions, and we might touch on them a bit later. But you know, what ended up happening in a big, you know, economic boom like we went through in 21 and halfway through 22 was, you know, a lot of companies got a lot of accelerated growth through, you know, just the fact that they're customers were hiring more, you know, sales and marketing folks, right? So they sold more seats. It's a nice tailwind to their business. What ends up happening, though, when those economic headwinds turn, or those tailwinds turn into headwinds, is all of a sudden those customers start reducing the size of their teams. And so they start reducing their seat counts. That turns into contraction for the business. And what was nice tailwind is now turning into headwind of contraction. Turns out, we may also touch on this later in our conversation, that a lot of these companies accelerated their own demise because in this run-up of economic boom, they chanted, more value, more value. We just want to win market share. We want to be the best offering on the market. So they added things like a bunch of automation or AI, things to make your team do more with less, which was all great. Oh man, this software is amazing. Our people can be so productive. But then on the flip side, oh man, we just laid off a bunch of folks. Actually, the folks we got left are way more productive now. We could even cut that further. And so we didn't monetize, those customers didn't monetize that additional functionality because it was all this market share growth. And so now they're turning to, you know, like people like me saying, hey, we're starting to lose our new business revenue. That's getting harder in this economic environment. Our expansion revenue has turned to contraction and we haven't properly thought through monetization. So that's the type of thing where companies will come talk to folks like me for.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important topic. I've never had anyone on the show, and I haven't really met too many people that are focused on pricing as a service, which is so critically important. What's your background? Like, how did you stumble into what you're doing?
Well, I've spent my entire 20-year career in software. I started more on the value creation side than the value capture side that I'm at today. So I started as a engineer down here in Austin, Texas, working for NI at writing drivers for Windows devices. So I blue screened my fair share of Windows 2000 machines more than I care to count. And then eventually engineering management. I ultimately, you know, realized or became more fascinated by how our products created, you know, customer value and turned into dollars for the business. And this interest led me to pursue my MBA. I didn't realize it then, but I was quite lucky with my MBA. The program I joined is pretty widely recognized for excellence in marketing, but I didn't find out until very recently. Very few business schools actually have courses in pricing. So I received my theoretical grounding in pricing there. And then during that internship, I went out to Silicon Valley, worked for a very successful startup out there. And the problem on the CEO's desk when I showed up is they were in the, I guess, call it B2C space. And so they were, you know, an app developer who sold through B2B. And so they had a couple of big partners. And one of those partners wanted all of their sort of app developers to have a freemium go-to-market approach. And so the company was like, well, we've got to create freemium for this one go-to-market partner. Should we do it for all of our go-to-market partners? And so this was a question on the CEO's desk. I show up, you know, happy, you know, MBA student looking for an interesting project to tackle. They say, hey, Dan, can you take a look at this for us? So I, among other projects I work on this summer, I did a bunch of analysis on freemium. TLDR, freemium is a terrible idea. Generally don't recommend it to everyone, but, you know, in except in very rare circumstances, we might circle back on that. But in general, that's where I got my initial sort of practical grounding in the pricing world. And, you know, after business school, spent a lot more time getting deep into value creation side of the business, product management, product strategy. You know, the company I was at, we acquired a ton of other companies. So I got to see a lot of early stage mistakes, both on the product and pricing side from those businesses we acquired. Because what would happen is we would acquire that company. The management team would go sailing off into the distance. And then as a product manager there, you know, I would have, you know, three or four products at a time that used to be separate entire companies that I have to manage and deal with all the legacy decisions that had been made and, you know, and write those ships. So I got a lot of experience there kind of, see, you know, in rapid fashion, seeing a lot of early stage mistakes. But then also, you know, at that company, product marketing technically owned pricing and packaging. But a lot of those folks, you know, they would have to go through a pricing and packaging exercise and they'd be like, I don't know what to do here. Like, I don't know, it's $49, $99. I have no idea what, like, and they'd be like, hey, Dan, you got some background. Could you help us out with this? So tangentially, and you know, I ended up taking on more and more responsibility there and doing a bit of work there. And, you know, I made mistakes out of the gate too. I don't care how good your theoretical grounding in pricing is. You're going to make a lot of mistakes when you try to apply them in the real world. And we can maybe go to some of those details in a bit. But, you know, ultimately, I went off on my own after, you know, holding a number of different product leadership positions. And about 4 years ago, now I have the privilege of helping founder CEOs and their teams build sustainable businesses, helping them make money and get their products in the hands of as many customers as possible.
Nice, nice. Well, with that, I mean, I can imagine you have some stories and you've learned quite a few things from even like companies that you were at, but also, you know, all of these clients that you're now advising and helping and thinking through this. And, you know, how does it go? Like, people, do they come to you with a specific pricing problem, or is it more like general, like, help me with product marketing, help me with go to market type of thing? Like, how does pricing get weaved in that? Because I've not really seen a specific, like, let's just have a pricing exercise that's really worked well. Like in my companies, I know every time we've done it, I've had an opinion, finance has had an opinion, product has had an opinion, sales has had an opinion, marketing's had an opinion. And it just seems like it always boils down to, well, what's the margin going to be? And how does that compare to anyone else that we think we're competing against? And bam, we have a price. I assume that's probably not the best way to do that.
Yeah, so I would say, unfortunately, I usually get brought in too late, which is usually the time where you pull the ripcord and say, we really need to bring in a professional here because now it's an emergency situation and we need to right the situation pretty quickly. And so I would say if there's one piece of advice or maybe a frame that would help is like, you don't really have a choice of whether you will have a pricing conversation with your customer. The only decision you get to make is when you will have this conversation. And please, for the love of God, don't make it on the shoulders of that poor sales rep who the first day the product is launched is trying to talk to a customer and they're like, how much does this cost? And they say X, and then they get laughed out of the room. Or even worse, probably more likely, is not laughter, but just confusion, because you've created some pricing and packaging scheme that your customers just like, I don't get it. I don't understand. And I see this with especially technical teams, technical founders all the time, where, you know, they'll be like, we'll be talking about such passion about solving a customer's problem. And there's such domain experts. And they're like, this is what the customer's experience, this is what they go through. And it's like, okay, great. How does your pricing scale? What is your pricing metric? Well, we price it by the number of gobble Googles. And you're like, what the heck is that? Well, that relates to our internal architecture and whatever. And you're like, wait, like, you just were so passionate about the customer and their problem. I could see the customer getting excited, their eyes lighting up, thinking all the problems you're going to solve for them. And then you take this hard left turn and make them understand your architecture, to understand your pricing model. And again, I think this goes to another point we may touch on as well. When it comes to SaaS pricing, most executives think that what you charge determines your success. No, in fact, who and how you charge determine your success. So we often think it's like, when we talk about pricing, I'll talk about pricing and packaging. I'll say pricing because it gets very annoying to say pricing and packaging over and over again. But it's this element of how are you wrapping this, you know, software up in a way that's consumable for your end customer, right? Forget the number. The number is most easily changed in a B2B context. So that being said, usually where I get brought in is, this is a fight I'll continue to fight, you know, one man shouting at the wind, I guess. But usually what ends up happening is there's somehow pricing got slotted into the go-to-market launch sequence. Is somebody at some point in a marketing boot camp got, you know, pricing and packaging was slotted there right next to, you know, launch the website. And so people, you know, think about it about a month before they launch, and then they go, oh no, we really haven't thought about this. And then they're like, this is not going to work. Maybe they show what they're going to do to some beta customers. They get some bad feedback. And then they called me and asked me to help. So.
Yeah, I can see that happening. So, I mean, how like in an ideal world, like how do you think a pricing experience, like how should companies actually think about it? Like how should they do it?
Yeah, so I mean, I use a overall model I call the services model for SaaS pricing. The services stands for four components of the model, S, V, C, and S. So that's a segments, value, competition, and strategy. So I find that companies usually face four significant challenges when they try to tackle pricing. They have unclear target customer profile. They don't understand what customers are serving. They'd be like, oh, we're going after doctors. And you're like, all doctors? You're going after neurosurgeons and your primary care physician. You're going in doctors in hospitals or doctors in clinics, rural doctors, urban doctors, like doctors who work and who own their own practice, or, you know, people just haven't thought through this, right? They have a poor understanding of how they create customer value. Value, I hate using this term because it sounds pedantic, but value illiteracy. Value is one of these terms that gets thrown around without crisp meaning. And in my world, value and price are so tightly interlinked that we really need to be precise about value. Otherwise, we can't have a workable conversation. They're unclear about their product's unique differentiation. Finally, they have a general underappreciation for the depth of decisions that go into a pricing and packaging approach. So they tend to think about pricing as a decision mainly around price level. You know, is this product, you know, $19 a user, is it $99 a user, is it $29.95? Should our prices end in fives or nines? Like, those are fantastic conversations. I love them. They're fun, but they come at the very end of the process. And honestly, they're the least important. Those are little optimization tweaks around the ends. We can talk about those if you want, but they're not what I do day to day. So this led me to create my services model. So services stands for the four components of the model, as I mentioned. So I promise this was a happy accident. You know, services for SaaS pricing. I didn't plan it that way. So we need to understand our customer segments first. You know, the context your customers are in is critical. They'll dictate the constraints they're facing. As we're going through that example of doctors, for, you know, it's like a doctor in an urban, you know, large hospital, you know, Cook County ER is going to be very different than your, you know, rural solo practice clinic doctor, right? They're going to have different constraints, different contexts, different needs. And that will cause them to value different value or rank different value drivers differently, which ones they view most important. And therefore, you know, value and price are interlinked. So that's going to change how they view your price. And then we need to really understand as well the competition. So that's a
third element of the model, because those different segments will have different competitive alternatives available to them. And we think about this in terms of what would this company do or this customer do if your company did not exist. So we think of those first three elements as inputs to our pricing process, because our pricing power really comes from understanding the differentiated value you create for a particular segment beyond the competitive alternatives available. And so then those three elements filter down into the final part of the services model, which is what I call strategy. And strategy I use in the Michael Porter sense of the word. So strategy is really about trade-offs. So many companies would like to be everything to everyone, but we have to decide. There's all these different segments of the market. There's different competition. But like a general planning their battle plan of like, which hill do we go after first? You know, do we, which beach on Normandy do we put our main attack vector? We have to make a decision, right? This is the core essence of strategy. So where are we best suited to play and win? Who are we going to target? How do we, you know, pricing is a function of positioning. So how do we position ourselves in these customers' mind to clarify our differentiated value? And how do we make all the necessary trade-offs among the different elements of packaging? So there'd be things like your price metrics, your price model, offer configurations, price fences. And then also finally thinking about our overall price level, how it will help us achieve our business objectives.
No, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, so what do you think this typical process is? Like how often do you do it? Is it constant? Like, running a SaaS company, how often should I be thinking about my pricing? Like, you brought up some good points earlier in the show about, you know, things change in your business. We have the year that we're going through, 2023, which is probably one of the hardest years for SaaS companies in a very, very long time. We don't know what 2024 is going to look like, but we are optimistic and starting to see some signs that maybe it's going to be a much stronger year. And it sort of already feels like things are changing a little bit, at least in the circles I play in. But from like, if I'm looking at my business saying, am I priced correctly? Like, is there something that I should trigger me, or is it just gut, or like, what's a good indication of things may have changed in your business, things may have changed with your customers, things may have changed with your competitors that triggers someone to go, I need to look at pricing? Or is it like every time I roll out a new price, a product, I have that pricing and I'm just going to stick to it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's different situations call for different measures. So there's no one magic number of how often we should update our pricing. I think, you know, anyone who is on a annual or 5-year planning cycle and just, you know, put the final stamp of approval on their 2020 decks in December of 2019 were sad when they ran into March 2020 and realized, oh my God, all that work we just did for the last 6 months to all this on our annual or 5-year planning cycle, we could just toss that all out the window, you know? So
you mean us launching Place in the beginning of 2020 and going, oh, we have all of the ideas, and like, oh shit.
None of that matters anymore. So look, you know, you may have a macro or systemic shock like that. You know, I would say in general, there's a couple of guardrails we could put in place. Like, there's pretty good data that supports best in class companies are doing something with their pricing about once a quarter. You should at least at an executive level be talking about pricing once a quarter. I was working with a client. Actually, this was before we started our engagement. I was talking to the CEO about doing a pricing project, and our initial sort of context conversations ended up straddling what was a 3-day executive offsite. So he goes, hey, yeah, so, you know, we met on like a Monday, and then toward, you know, Wednesday through Friday was the exec offsite. And so I got a bunch of information from him on Monday, and then we had a call set up the next week. So I get on the phone with him the next week, and he's like, yeah, so like, let's talk about this project. And I was like, awesome. So what did you guys, was there any change, you know, to the plan given, or your context, given what you guys discussed in your 3-day exec offsite? And he goes, well, no, we didn't talk about pricing. I was like, wait, you had your entire, this is a Silicon Valley unicorn. Like someone, a company that had just raised an ungodly amount of money. And CEO's like, well, no, we didn't talk about pricing in 3 days of executive offsite. He's like, you had 3 full days with the most expensive meeting you could run at your company, and pricing didn't come up once. To me, that seems, if I was his board, I would maybe have had a word with him about that, because that just seems like negligent. But I don't know. So it should at least be, you know, It should at least get 30 minutes in that 3 days. I think that it merits that much. It's a giant growth lever. I think there's really only 3 ways to grow a SaaS business: acquisition, retention, and monetization. And you're leaving like an entire area unexplored, right? I think all the attention, all the conversation goes to acquisition. And so, you know, for better or worse, you know, I think it's a great opportunity for me. And it's one of the reasons why I think pricing is such a powerful lever, because nobody really focuses on it, but it's just this massive opportunity. And so, you know, going back to what we were saying, you know, companies, you're constantly improving your product. I don't know any CEO, any head of product that's like, yep, product's done. I mean, maybe at the very end of the life cycle, you know, maybe there's a DB2 database or something out there, right? An IBM mainframe version that's like never going to be updated. But most companies are not in that situation. You're like planning the next sprint. You're planning the next version, the next quarter, what's going to be on the roadmap for next year. So your value is constantly updating. Competitors are constantly releasing products. There's going to be macroeconomic changes, 50-year high inflation, whatever it might be. So I think, you know, if it's been, you know, I talk about guardrails, I think best-in-class companies, you know, will do something with their pricing once a quarter. I think a good rule of thumb is if it's been more than 2 years, it's probably time to get serious and do something, right? Some modification. And look, that doesn't have to be just messing with the price point. That can be creating a new bundle. It could be creating a new add-on. It could be price localization. It could be updating your discounting policies, right? It could be updating discount authority matrices. It could be updating your internal governance procedures. So I think just in general, you know, it's too often not considered, you know, what I said before, kind of in the beginning of our conversation, is a process. It's more like an event. We did that pricing thing like 4 years ago. Like, that's good enough, right? And it's like, well, did you have the same product, the same market 4 years ago? Probably not. You are seeing a lot of that actually recently, but because of that economic shock that we had with COVID, what you saw was a lot of companies that had for good reason, both to protect their brand, but also I think for general love of rest of humanity, said, well, we're not going to be the people that are perceived as taking advantage, like in a pandemic, and raising our prices. So while you may have seen normal price increases during that time, a lot of people held off. And so now I think what you're seeing is outsized price increases from folks. One, I think the main thing that's getting blamed is inflation, but also because a lot of the companies held off on their standard sort of annual price increases because they didn't want to be seen as you know, taking advantage of a bad situation or losing, you know, customers in a severe downturn. So you're seeing some of that catch up happen. So that's part of it, can be part of the mix too.
The big thing I took away from that was like it sounded like the reason why you feel pricing needs to be looked at as often as possible is because it is a lever to grow the business. It's not just an exercise of, are we priced fairly and can we squeeze a little bit more, but it's actually a strategic lever of, how are we competing? Can we compete differently? Our markets change, the world's changed. Is there a better way of packaging what we're doing that's going to lead to more sales, more retention, all of that? That's what I took from why it's so important. Not necessarily because maybe you got the pricing wrong, which is where I was first going with the conversation of like, you rolled it out 2 years ago. Maybe you just didn't price it the way you could have priced it. It's more so, who cares what you did 2 years ago? Like, what's the state now? And how do you leverage everything going on in the market with your customers and with the products you offer now to really capture the true value of your product and have customers pay you for that real value that you're delivering?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one way to think about the pricing and packaging conversation is, if it's done well, it can accelerate everything in your go-to-market. If it's done poorly, it can pour sand in the gears of your go-to-market engine. So it can increase your customer acquisition costs, because all of a sudden you get customers that are confused or that take too long to decide between different offerings, or, you know, they're trying to choose from a Chinese menu of a bunch of different things and they don't get it, right? Or it can, you know, obviously you lose potential revenue if you're underpriced, right? And if you've added value significantly, you know, your value, your price could have been absolutely nailed, but you've added value, right? So your value has changed. Maybe your relative value has changed compared to your competitors. You know, I think a lot of CEOs probably have pride in their company and what they've achieved. You know, so why wouldn't your price change? You know, and look, your price can go the other way too, right? I think a lot of misconception that folks have, especially when we throw around this word of value-based pricing, people always think it means like increasing your pricing. It's like, maybe, you know, it's like, no, actually we've got to lower our prices because, you know, for a particular segment, et cetera, that we need to change. And, you know, we think about, well, I don't want to get political, but, you know, we a lot of folks have this in terms of, you know, taxes, right? We have, you know,
there's a progressive tax system in the, for example, the US, and what happens there? There's a cross subsidization that happens, right? We charge people who have more and more, right? And we provide services to people who have less. And so, you know, in a business is really no different, right? There's higher willingness to pay, higher budgets, right? And doing so, we're going to cross subsidize people that can pay more with people who maybe can't afford it or at a lower, you know, ability to pay. And so we need to think of like, are we balanced across all the different, going back to my original model, the services model with segments, like, are we sharing value in a balanced way across, you know, different segments? Because different segments will be getting different value from it. I think one example I love is, you know, it's like, well, how much should a crowbar cost? You know, well, I don't know, maybe $5 at the hardware store. It's like, well, what would you be willing to pay for it if you're prying nails out of a 2x4 versus I got to go open this treasure chest? You know, it's like all of a sudden you'd be willing to pay a lot more than $5. Right. And so people be like, well, that's insane. You can't charge more, you know, you can't charge someone $1,000 for crowbars. Like, look, if he's going to open treasure chests, he's going to be more than happy to, you know, pay me $1,000. Like I might feel cheated if I sell it to him for $5 and then find out what he was going to do with it. So, you know, we need to think about that. Are we sharing value, aligned our pricing to how we're creating value in different markets?
Yeah, especially if that treasure chest is about to sink and you only have a very small amount of time to get it open, like you're going to do whatever you need to do. One of the things that we briefly talked about in the prep call that I wanted to bring up, because I do think it's really insightful, is when you were talking about there's always a concern that customers are going to like freak out about a price change. But, you know, what about the internal conversations? What about the internal at the company reaction? Because I've been guilty of this myself, feeling that we're either charging too much or charging too little and getting scared or nervous as to what's going to happen. And like I've seen other people on my teams internally have that same type of reaction. What is that like and how do you manage that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And, you know, it really, for the type of work I do, it really depends client to client, because you'll have some client CEOs that are absolute cowboys. We shoot from the hip, see what happens. Some are absolutely like, we need the FP&A team to run a scenario analysis 25 different ways. We need all these conjoint studies, right? I had a friend who she was a brand manager at General Mills. And she told me, she's like, look, if we change the price of Cheerios, and the revenue or profit goes down, none of us get our bonuses for 5 years. So of course we're going to pay McKinsey $5 million for a pricing study, because it like all that's all on the line for us. So look, it really depends upon what is your risk reward trade-off for any pricing decision. Really, you're looking at, pricing is simple, but it's not easy. Like, what is the difference in expected revenue? What is the difference in cost incurred? I think I mentioned at the beginning, if you're just looking at like, oh, we should raise prices 5%, you're probably not going to call me, because your risk profile trade-off of revenue and cost is not that big of a deal. But you're going to call me and be like, we think we're going to 2X our prices, and we think we're gonna, like, there's a huge churn risk, huge conversion risk. Like, we'd really want to get, you know, some precision in modeling this out and some approach on rollout, et cetera, right? That's when I get the phone call. So, you know, like I said, we were talking about, in your question was, you know, yes, customers do get anchored to prices. You know, we tend to, you know, if I'm sure most of your audience remembers what the price of gasoline was when they started driving. You know, it's like, you know, that's the old, back in my day, gas was only 79 cents a gallon. You know, what's going on? All right. So we tend to have those formative remembrances, right? But it happens in companies too. So there was a client I was working with where, like I said, I get called in pretty, unfortunately, late in the process. I think, you know, pricing, I would actually put pricing at the very end of a product development process, right? Figure out what your customers are willing to pay for and then go build that. Don't build what you think they want and then ask them later what they're willing to pay for it. I think that's totally backwards. And there's very successful companies that work in exactly that manner. I think it's when we talk, I've spent a lot of my time in the product management world. And look, if you ask any customer, hey, if we built this, would you want that? The answer is always going to be yes. But if you ask them, hey, if we built this and charge you an extra $10 a month, that's a totally different question. That's a totally different question, but I find that your product managers don't usually ask that. So in general, you know, this client I would happen to be working with, you know, a really good team, you know, really smart, you know, checking all the boxes in terms of just talent, but, you know, like most companies, not didn't have a deep background in pricing and packaging. They're building a new product. The SVP of product has, given exec updates, kind of 6 months out, needs to put together kind of an overview of what the pricing and packaging looks like, and needs to pick a price point for the new offering that they're going to have. It just kind of picks it out of air, right? It's like, oh, well, we charge X for our current product. We think we can get 2X. No research, just I got to put something on a slide. So, fast forward, that's 6 months pre-launch, fast forward 4 months to 2 months pre-launch, and everyone's like, been looking at this slide in regular updates, once every couple of weeks in the exec meeting room. And, they're like, hey guys, we're about to launch. We're in that part of the go-to-market launch plan where it says we need to really solidify our pricing and packaging. So how confident are we in these numbers? So they're like, oh, we're not very, we didn't really do any research, but we all knew that. So maybe we should go do that now. And so they give me a call because they were strapped, and this is the other side effect of waiting till the very end is because I don't know if you've ever been on a product development team as you're ramping up to launch. Like, it's not like everyone just goes on vacation, but pressure gets more intense. Like, everyone's been aligned to a deadline. The product team's burning the midnight oil. The engineers are on call, right? Like, everyone's like, and all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, by the way, go run this pricing and packaging exercise. And you're run up to get the entire go-to-market team prepared for the product launch. You're like, no way. So I get called and we go do some external market research. And I bring back what I think is going to be good news. Like, hey guys, you thought you were going to charge 2X. Actually, the market is telling me they'd be willing to pay 4X. What I didn't expect is that the anchoring that we talked about on the customer side also exists on the internal executive side. So even though there is a number without any basis in research or fact being shown to them, everyone got really attached to that 2X number, because that was just a number. And this is, I'm really a big fan of all the behavioral economics literature. And there's a lot of work on anchoring. Anchors have nothing to do with reality. I mean, they have these, guess how many jelly beans are in a jar. If they ask you to write down the last four digits of your social security number before that, you end up having a like crazy amount of correlation to your social security number in terms of what your answer is going to be for jelly beans in a jar, even though the two are completely unrelated, right? So, humans, it's funny because in every human has a interesting relationship with money. Whatever your upbringing was, rich or poor, I don't care. But we all have, some emotional bias. We have this, I think, illusion that we bring everyone together in a business and we all become these rational economic, homo economicus, economic actors. And it doesn't happen. You have a bunch of behavioral irrationality in the room. And it's just the same. So how do you navigate that? I would say cautiously and carefully. I think a couple of things you can do is one thing that will blow up on you and has happened before in engagements is if you are not sort of very clear upfront with the goals, the expected outcomes, and the methodology, then if you bring back surprising information, instead of being surprised and delighted, like, oh my God, like our product's that valuable, like people will pay 2X more. Instead, what will happen is people will start attacking the methodology, and that's not a position you want to be starting from. So I think, kind of my advice to folks would be if the better you can elaborate, hey, like you guys are priced at 2X. Okay. What if the data came back at 6X? What would you think? What would be your reaction? Is that good news? Is that bad news? Like, having those conversations before going and spending $50,000 plus on a pricing study is probably a good use of your time.
Awesome. Well, we are out of time, but I do want to ask you one last question. So what do you think other founders and execs, what should everyone be focused on right now?
AI is the number one thing that all the CEOs I talk to want to talk about. I think it's just absolutely disruptive in so many dimensions. We were talking about tearing up the five-year plan kind of jokingly with the COVID input. And I think a bunch of VPs of products, chief product officers went through a similar thing with ChatGPT got launched. They had to tear up their one-year roadmap plans and all right, well, we got to do a bunch of AI stuff now. Every board is asking their CEOs, what's your AI strategy? And I think, not just from a product perspective, but also an internal operations perspective, it's changing so much. And where that intersects with my world is you see all of these companies, whether it's Microsoft with their recent announcement of adding AI pretty much everywhere, but specifically Office 365, obviously OpenAI doing a ton of work, all the major players from the foundational models, but then all of the startups that are building additional capabilities, but everyone from Notion to pick your software, they're adding an AI component. Where that's really rubber meeting the road is I've never seen more uncertainty on both the value and the cost side of the equation. And in pricing, those are two fundamental inputs. Like, and we didn't mention this, but you know, any pricing decision really is the influence of four different factors, which is cost, customer willingness to pay, customer value, and competition. And the customer value and customer in cost is highly variable, right? You imagine if you're a company adopting these foundational models, paying OpenAI some fee for API access or whoever it might be, all of a sudden that's a bunch of marginal cost you didn't have to think of before, right? That's coming off your P&L. And then also, you know, a lot of these models, you know, it's like, what is the use case? What, like, how are people going to use this? We don't know, right? And so the clear sort of, well, look, I get this marketing automation platform, it allows me to send more emails. The more emails I send, there's a real clear, like, hey, I make this members of my marketing team X percent more efficient. I can translate that into a value equation, dollars and cents for the business. We still, a lot of these use cases are still being fleshed out. I think the proper user experience, even, and then going into the variable cost, like, what's the tech stack look like? Like, do you have an entire different, you know, team supporting that? Are there other operational components you need to invest in? You know, how much are going to be our OpenAI bill every month, right? So I think that's occupying a lot of brain space in the CEOs I talk to, and I recommend if you're not focused on it now, you probably should be.
Yeah, no, no doubt. Absolutely. Well, like I said, we are out of time. We could continue this conversation because there's a lot to learn here, a lot to understand, but appreciate you coming on and sharing some insight, and glad you popped on.
Awesome. Hopefully it was valuable for your audience. I was super excited to be here. So thank you very much.
Everyone else, Cash and Burn comes out every Tuesday. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.